From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey. And have you seen it lately? It's such a strange and mysterious film. It's considered the director Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, but when the critics first saw it, they thought it was incomprehensible and self-indulgent. The writer Michael Benson has a book about Space Odyssey. He's joining us to talk about Kubrick's vision for the film and the ideas and the technology that went into it. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, most of you have seen Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, A Space Odyssey. If you haven't, we're going to give away some of the story, so you may want to save this show for later. But if you have, you probably had a reaction that went something like this. What was that? Or, wait, what happened? Or, where did that baby come from? Or maybe it was just, wow. Kubrick's cinematic exploration of the grandeur and mystery of the universe is extraordinary, even now. But he didn't make it easy for the audience. The pacing, the lack of exposition, and let's be honest, the critics' first reaction was not, well, it wasn't great. One wrote the film was somewhere between hypnotic and immensely boring. Another said they had never seen such a piece of junk in their life. The great Pauline Kael said it was trash masquerading as art. But it was also a massive box office hit, and it's considered Kubrick's masterpiece. Today in the program, we're talking about Space Odyssey with the writer Michael Benson. Benson's book is about how the futurist and science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick came up with this film. Benson is a writer whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone. He joined us from a studio in Ljubljana, Slovenia, where he's based, and we began the conversation with his own reaction to 2001 Space Odyssey, which he first saw when he was six. He says none of the sequences of the film that so baffled critics at the time bothered him because he says when you're six, your mind is incredibly open.
2001 is very nonverbal. It relies a lot on visual impact, and it tells its story visually. It has a strong connection to the silent movies of decades before in that sense. And so even though I was six, it really communicated to me on various, you know, levels that were nonverbal, and that's probably a good thing. If you're 6 years old, you're not really ready for prime time when it comes to verbal expression necessarily. But
yeah.
Something about the power of those images really transmitted to me.
You write about how lucky you were to experience the film at that age because, as you put it in the book, your receptors at that age are about as open as they'll ever be, which I think is interesting when you look at, and this is maybe not a theme in the book, but the difference in the reactions between young people and older people in this film is pretty interesting. You had the reaction of a young person. You didn't need this conscious understanding of it. You were just taking it in as a visual experience in some ways.
Well, that's right. And, you know, films after sound, especially big budget Hollywood films, became to a large extent filmed plays. You know, they became much more static because cameras couldn't really move around as much when you had and you know, you had these big microphones. Cameras had to be surrounded by sound baffling material. They got very heavy. Films got less interesting visually after sound came in the, you know, 20s and 30s. With 2001, as I said, you know, in a way you're going back to pure visual storytelling. I was on the early, you know, the young end of that spectrum of, you know, kids to probably to young adults who really love 2001. But definitely I fit into, I guess, that demographic, yeah. You know, of younger people interested in seeing something that's nonverbal, and who can respond to something that's nonverbal. And I'm sure at age six, if it had been a filmed play or, you know, a much more wordy kind of film, I probably would have gotten bored and not sat through the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. Stanley Kubrick, that you write about, he had this inclination in this relationship with Arthur C. Clarke. He had this inclination to remove as much verbal explication as possible, and that was kind of part of, it seems like, the dispute that they had. Clarke is wanting to keep explaining things. It seems like Kubrick didn't want to do that. He wanted it. He wanted to take out the explicit, make it a more visual experience.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, Clarke was a writer, and you know, he was all about explaining things and describing things, and he was one of the very best at it, especially in science fiction. So you're talking about two masters in two different mediums trying to work in the medium of the second guy, who is Kubrick. Yeah. And Kubrick, you know, by the way, it's interesting because Stanley Kubrick did have voiceover narration in Doctor Strangelove, which preceded 2001, and in Clockwork Orange, which followed 2001. He had voiceover narration in a bunch of his films.
Yeah.
But he had the instinct, and it was retrospectively, it's definitely the right instinct to remove that. I mean, he had Clarke, he had Arthur Clarke writing voiceover narrations up until November of 67. The film finally came out in April 68. So it was very, very close to the end that he still had Arthur writing voiceovers. And then he had this, you know, kind of no guts, no glory decision or realization that, you know, the film really should speak in its own way and in its own language. You know, he had other multiple opportunities to make sequences more clear and more obvious in the dialogue. And to spell out for the audience more clearly what was going on. And he just methodically stripped the film down to the minimum when it came to explication for the audience. And the net result was adding mystery, layers of opacity and mystery to this film.
There's this quote you include in the book, in the acknowledgments, actually, where Kubrick is talking about this line from a Jean Cocteau film, Orpheus, where this poet asks what he should do, and he's told, astonish me. And
yes.
That seems to have been something that Kubrick was really taken by. He says very little of modern art does that, and seems like that's what he was trying to accomplish with this in all of his films, was this kind of mystery and astonishment.
I think you're right, and I think 2001 was the high point of that. It was absolutely his greatest film. I mean, not to put the other ones down, but, you know, 2001 is just so stunning on so many different levels. And I think he did succeed. You know, the other line, which I believe was Ezra Pound's line connected to modernism by, you know, generations of art historians, you know, which his line was, make it new.
Yeah.
That was the kind of those were the marching orders of modernism, make it new. And I think that in many dimensions and on many levels with 2001, Kubrick succeeded in making it new in filmmaking technique, in the ability to convey vast sweeps of space and time, tracing the trajectory of the human species from pre-human primates to post-human, you know, star children. You know,
yeah.
We see one example at the very end. All of those things, they made it new, and they, yeah, and I think that they did astonish. They certainly astonished me at age six, but, you know, I have to say, I mean, when I see the film today, having seen it innumerable times, I'm still astonished by the achievement.
Yeah. I'm sure there are people listening who haven't seen the film, and so it's a classic, so we're going to go ahead with spoilers, of course, so fair warning for people, but give us a sense of basically what I suppose what is happening, though we can talk about all of this as we go. But as you say earlier in the book, basically, I'll put it as you do, the meddlesome gods of the ancients have become an inscrutable, prying alien super race, and the instrument of their power is this rectangular black monolith, which appears at key points in the human story. I guess those are the basics for us to understand where this this plot, I guess, if you can put it that way, starts?
Yeah. To compress the story is, you know, we enter the film and we see pre-human primates who are starving in Africa, and they seem to be on the way out. They don't really have their act together. And along comes one night this mysterious object, accompanied by the music of Hungarian avant-garde composer Ligeti. Right. And it seems to in some way transmit or coax them into understanding, you know, into a next level of evolution. By planting the seed of the idea that in the scene that we see, one of the most intelligent of the man-apes realizes that a heavy thigh bone of a skeleton that's just lying there on the desert floor could be essentially weaponized and used as, you know, used to kill some of the creatures that are just grazing all around these primates, because they're not threatened by the primates because the primates haven't learned how to use weapons yet. Then we see the tribe of man-apes eating, you know, companionably eating meat, and, you know, they've become carnivores and they're on their way to success. Next time we see the monolith, it has been – we're in the year 2001. There's an extraordinary match cut between the bone weapon being thrown into the sky ecstatically by the primate who has, you know, learned how to use it. Moonwatcher is his name in the novel. Yeah. Match cut to an orbiting satellite of some kind.
Yeah.
And it turns out that another monolith has been discovered on the moon by contemporary humans, or, you know, from the vantage point of 1968, humans, right, 30 years in the future.
Yeah.
Without any knowledge of the prior monolith in Africa millions of years before. And when they excavate it, and the sun hits it for the first time in millions of years, it sends a radio signal to Jupiter, in the direction of Jupiter. So the second act of the film is basically a bureaucrat, a senior bureaucrat going to the moon to take a look at the monolith. And then when the sun hits it, it sends this radio signal. Third act of the film is a huge spacecraft being sent off towards Jupiter to investigate, with a supercomputer named HAL on it. Dave Bowman succeeds in deprogramming or lobotomizing HAL, and then goes through this extraordinary transformation in Jupiter space, having arrived alone in this vast spacecraft, and you have these extraordinary transformations of the man. But that's basically the really the fourth act. So your first act is the man-ape. Second is the trip to the moon. The third is the trip to Jupiter. And then the fourth is, you could say, fourth and fifth. There are two sequences then. One is called the Stargate sequence, of this sort of psychedelic journey that Bowman takes, which the aliens evidently take him on, you know, through time and space, and he sees extraordinary sights. One of the amazing things there is that the visual effects that they did using analog techniques way pre-CGI, you know, in 65, 66, they do not, I mean, by and large, they don't look dated today. They're rather extraordinary. I mean, if you talk to visual effects professionals today and ask them about that, they'll say, yeah, it really holds up well. Then finally you have the rebirth. You have this hotel room, mysterious hotel room. It's kind of like a zoo cage that the aliens, who are never seen apart from the monolith, we never find out if the monolith is the aliens or what is going on there.
Right.
A French period, a Louis XIV hotel room has been created at the end of this space-time journey of the astronaut, and he's kind of put in there in a kind of holding cage, like a zoo cage. And then he you know, almost like in the Riddle of the Sphinx, he goes through multiple stages of his life. He ages rapidly, and then you see him on his deathbed, and he's resurrected he's on his deathbed, and he's the monolith appears at the foot of that bed, and then he's resurrected into this floating fetus, which returns to Earth. Roll credits, and the rest is history.
That's Michael Benson. His book is Space Odyssey: Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone, listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the film 2001, A Space Odyssey. The writer Michael Benson has a book about the film. He's joining us to talk about Kubrick's vision for the film and the ideas and the technology that went into it. Let's back up 4 years before the film comes out, 1964. Arthur C. Clarke gets word that the director Stanley Kubrick wants to talk to him. And it takes him a while to finally catch up with Kubrick. But Kubrick sends him this letter. And one of the things that he says in the letter is that he wanted to talk about the possibility of doing what he put, this is how he put it, the proverbial really good science fiction movie. Talk about what Kubrick is interested in. Why does he get in touch with Clarke?
Kubrick had read a lot of science fiction as a kid. He always thought that there was a lot of potential in the genre, but that the characters were rather thin, which, you know, people might think is ironic given that all the human characters in 2001, you know, their characters are rather thin. It's only HAL 9000, the computer, that really seems to have much character.
Right.
But in any case, I got a direct quote from Tony Fruin, who was a young assistant to Kubrick in, you know, during the production of 2001, and in their very first meeting, they had a long discussion about science fiction and cinema. And Kubrick said to Tony, "Cinema has let science, or you know, filmmaking has let science fiction down." And his motivation really was to rise to the level of the great science fiction novels that he'd read, and perhaps go beyond.
Yeah. Kubrick is interested in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. He's interested on the impact that it could have or may have had on the Earth. He's interested in this idea of these space probes. And it makes Arthur Clarke think about this book that he had written called The Sentinel. It's interesting the way you write about the different things that Clarke had been writing about and how they emerge as plot points in the film.
Yeah, that was actually a short story, The Sentinel.
Yeah.
He wrote it in the early 50s for a BBC story competition, and he didn't even place. And it simply narrated the discovery of an object on the moon, a pyramid-shaped crystal object, which the research party or the exploration party that had discovered it, Lunar Exploration Party, eventually concluded must be an early warning device placed on the moon so that if the many species that could be seen millions of years ago on the surface of the Earth, if any of them eventually developed intelligence and the ability to bridge the gap between the Earth and the moon, that they might discover this thing and set off this, you know, what the story describes as something like a burglar alarm to alert the aliens who had placed the thing there that intelligence had arisen on planet Earth. And it ends on a kind of interesting, ominous note, you know, where the narrator says, when he looks at the Milky Way now, he wonders from where in those banked clouds of stars they will come when they come. And so when Clarke was contacted by Kubrick and Kubrick asked him to consider collaborating with him, he immediately started going over all the different stories he'd written and novels he'd written, more stories than novels, just inventorying them and trying to figure out what would make the best film. And he quickly settled on The Sentinel as a potential core sequence or core of a movie.
Yeah. You say in the book that one of the kind of the initial motivations for Clarke and Kubrick as they're working all of this out was the universal structure of human myths.
Yes.
And Joseph Campbell was kind of an influence or gave them a kind of a template. Would you talk a little bit about that, this idea of mythology?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because they consciously This is really under Kubrick's direction. Each of them brought a lot to the table, you know. So Clark brought his ideas to the table, obviously, in the form of the Sentinel. And meanwhile, Kubrick was reading about mythology, and he read The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is Joseph Campbell's masterpiece, a look at the universal characteristics of all known human mythologies. And he boiled it down to almost like a haiku, you know, or, you know, very short formula, which is the hero undergoes separation, initiation, and then return.
Yeah.
So the hero, you know, in the Odyssey, Ulysses, you know, the Odysseus goes, you know, he's separated from his home and he's initiated into all kinds of, you know, he has all these affairs with goddesses, et cetera, et cetera. And then he returns and reclaims his kingdom. And almost every human mythology from every culture has a similar separation, initiation, and return. And so at one point in 64, Kubrick handed Clark A Hero with a Thousand Faces and said, you really have to read this because I think there's a lot of material there. You know, there are ideas in here that we could really use. Mm. And Clark read it with great interest and fascination. And luckily, he was keeping a journal during that period. And you know, in one of his journal entries, he mentions it. So we know that happened.
I have to say that one of the revelations of your book in terms of the collaboration between Kubrick and Clark was kind of the contradiction in their worldviews. You had Clark, who you describe as an optimist, and Kubrick is a skeptic. So you have this,
yes,
as you say, this idealism playing against cynicism. You have belief playing against, you know, agnosticism. You have death. You have rebirth. So both of these impulses were playing against each other, it seems, in creating the film.
Yeah, Doug, I'm really glad you mentioned that. I've actually compared it to – there's a kind of famous story about Lennon and McCartney. McCartney comes into the studio one day, you know, with a new song that he'd been working on the previous night, and he says, listen to this, lads, and he plays this song, you know, it's getting better all the time, you know, and it's all filled with joy, the joy of life, and everything's getting better, better, better. And Lennon got a hold of the lyrics, and he just added, it couldn't get much worse.
Right.
And so you had those two sensibilities, you know. I mean, McCartney following the Beatles was kind of maybe unfairly criticized as being just kind of bubblegum pop, you know, it was just kind of pop. But, you know, McCartney together with Lennon created a near perfect collaboration, producing some of the greatest music of the 60s. And, you know, and with Kubrick and Clark, I mean, Kubrick alone, without an optimist to collaborate with, you know, on the contrary, Anthony Burgess, you know, with Clockwork Orange, he produced one of the most horrifyingly cynical, yep, pieces of work I've ever seen, or not cynical really, but just savage, you know, uncompromising and heavy. Clockwork Orange, the next film after 2001. But when he worked with Clark, something about that, I think that was almost as good a collaboration, if not more so, than Lennon and McCartney.
Well, the Star Child, I think you describe it in the book as maybe the most optimistic viewpoint or character in any kind of Stanley Kubrick film. And it was Clark's idea.
Well, actually, you know, that's another interesting point. Clark was very influenced by a Russian utopian futurist who most Americans don't know the name of. His name was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky was the guy who came up with the formula in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the mathematical equations proving that liquid-fueled multi-stage rockets could achieve Earth orbit and go beyond the Earth. He's considered the father of rocketry. He was also kind of a mystic utopian, you know, philosopher. And he came out with one of the great single statements which launched the space age, and Earth is the cradle of the mind, but humanity cannot remain in its cradle forever. And that, you know, launched a million rockets. It launched a lot of novels. It certainly influenced Clark. Clark's most famous novel is Childhood's End. I think that's a direct reference to Tsiolkovsky's formulation. And by the way, Clark quoted that to Kubrick, and Kubrick was well aware of it. And Kubrick quoted it in turn when he was interviewed during the production of 2001 and called it a marvelous statement. And so I think that the rebirth, the human rebirth at the end of 2001, that Star Child is in a way a literalization of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky's great utopian formulation, that Earth is the cradle of the mind, but we can't remain in the cradle forever.
Yeah. Let's talk about that dawn of man scene you mentioned. Because I think it's interesting the way you put it in context. We're talking, you know, in the mid-1960s, paleoanthropology, this, you know, science of human evolution, is emerging, and it's starting to revolutionize the way we understand, you know, the origins of humans. And I guess this interested Kubrick, and it interested Clark as a way of looking at the human condition by going way back to our origins.
Science fiction at its best, or at least hard science fiction at its best, is using what science is uncovering and discovering and theorizing about and putting it at the service of fiction. And certainly Clark was you know, as interested or almost as interested in what was going on in what we were finding out about our origins as he was about the future of the race. And in fact, before he met Kubrick, he had already written an essay in which he talked about how it's incorrect or it's too simple to say that humans invented tools and then built civilization with it. He said, rather, it's more that tools invented humanity, invented civilization, because, you know, you develop a tool, you make a tool, and then the tool changes the human being who invented it. And there's kind of a feedback loop there. Now, I'm very much paraphrasing from what he wrote. He wrote much more elegantly than I'm speaking right now. But so he definitely discussed this with Kubrick in New York in 64, 65. You know, this paradox that actually tools also change us. We make tools, but then they make us, which is something you see in an accelerating pace, you know, with high tech now.
Yeah. There's that crucial moment you mentioned when Moonwatcher has this realization that the thigh bone of this animal can be used as a weapon. And Dan Richter, who we'll talk about, who's the actor, amazing actor, it sounds like, fascinating character you write about, and we'll get to that in a second here. But he believed that one reason Kubrick shot this scene so many times, even though Kubrick shot every scene so many times, but Richter believes that one of the reasons Kubrick shot that scene so many times was because he was, as you put it in the book, discovering the meaning of a scene and learning something new each time. And to me, that was an interesting insight about the way Kubrick worked, is that his obsession with shooting takes over and over and over again was kind of an exploration process in some way.
Yes. Also, he wasn't necessarily the most articulate guy on the set. You know, actors would say, you know, when they got to take number 23 or even take number 5, you know, well, Stanley, what would you like me to do differently? And he would say, well, let's just try it again. You know, he was not necessarily – he needed to see things before he could decide. That was kind of his MO, and Stanley had to see something demonstrated or see a three-dimensional, you know, model of something in order to understand what a set would really be able to do. It was hard to do it verbally with him. Which, by the way, might also be a key, you know, one of the keys into why 2001 is so nonverbal.
Right.
Not necessarily.
Right.
We don't necessarily have to go there. But, Dan Richter is he's a great guy. Very articulate, very sensitive, very thoughtful mime. He was a mime, refugee of the American Mime Theater of New York when Kubrick met him, living in London. He was really up close and personal with Kubrick for that entire key Dawn of Man sequence as the main character and the choreographer of it. And so he has a unique insight into Stanley's technique and method and rationale, I think.
How much influence did Dan Richter have on Andy Serkis?
I have no idea. That's a really good question.
Yeah, because it seems like Serkis is just like Richter in some ways. I mean, creating these animal movements and movements so crucial to the characters.
That's a really good point, and that had occurred to me also. It's just that Dan was working, he was fortunate to be working with one of the great makeup artists in the history of film. His name is Stuart Freeborn, mm-hmm. who later went on to create, you know, the Wookiees of Star Wars and Yoda and, you know, characters that are, you know, sold in their millions in the form of little dolls and all that kind of stuff for, you know, Lucas's franchise. But he really... it would be wrong to say he cut his teeth on 2001 because he had had a long career before 2001. But when it came to the challenge of making believable Australopithecus Afrikaansis, you know, which is a very tough one, his collaboration with Dan Richter, they needed each other because Dan couldn't do man-apes with body movement alone. And Stuart certainly couldn't do man-apes with, you know, without having a good skinny mime within those suits that he ended up making, those man-ape costumes. I can't call them suits, actually. Yeah. Freeborn succeeded in making these foam rubber masks that transmitted the facial expressions of the performer underneath in an almost magical fashion. With lots and lots and lots of all-nighters and, you know, trial and error experiments and pure dedication. And we're talking about, somebody once said art is a form of fanaticism. And if art is a form of fanaticism, then certainly Dan Richter and Stuart Freeborn proved it with 2001. And, you know, the net result was a really, I would say, extraordinarily believable tribes of these man-apes.
I love the part you talk about where Dan Richter, but by the way, it's fascinating. He's also a heroin and cocaine addict.
Yes.
during the time, it's pretty amazing. But he makes this real connection with his character, with Moonwatcher, when he goes to the London Natural History Museum and he's able to hold these casts of ancient, you know, primitive humans and these fossils, and he gets in contact with his character. I love that part.
Yeah, you know, when I was interviewing him, it suddenly occurred to me that he had a kind of an epiphany holding a bone or a fossilized bone in the Natural History Museum, and then he had the challenge of transmitting to the audience his character having a kind of epiphany or dawning realization while holding another bone, which is the thigh bone of the skeleton that he'd been scrabbling in, you know.
I want to ask about, you mentioned HAL 9000, of course, fascinating sequence. And I'm wondering if you think that reads differently today, that our sense of AI, if you're comparing it to an audience in 1968, if it reads differently today, if it seems more plausible today to audiences.
I think that it seemed plausible then, and that was the great achievement of those scenes, that people – it was not some Robbie the Robot rolling up and shedding nuts and bolts on the floor and, you know, looking right. Kind of comic. I mean, you know what I mean? HAL 9000, you know, first of all, I should say that Kubrick and Clark consulted with the best minds in the business. I'm talking about organic human minds, you know. At MIT, you know, Marvin Minsky, who was co-founder of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab, a genuine pioneer in AI, and then other people like I.J. Goode, who had worked with Alan Turing in Bletchley Park in the UK, you know, during the Second World War, and was a leading London-based AI researcher. And you know, they really were serious about going to people who knew what they were talking about and had put a lot of thought into some of these topics, like AI, spaceflight, you know, et cetera, and really picking their brains. And so HAL is believable. I think HAL was just as believable in 68 as HAL is now. Yeah. And it was very spooky for a lot of people that you had this talking computer that somehow the filmmaking convinced the audience that they were halfway between Earth and Jupiter, and that a computer was running amok.
I like how you describe the scene where he shuts down HAL, deprograms him. I was mentioning this earlier. You call it a methodical lobotomization, and it is. It seems like for you, it was one of the most affecting scenes in the film.
Well, I think, you know, there's something – first of all, it's a science fiction scene par excellence. I mean, you know, you have the computer and the human being. You know, you have a intelligence created by human beings and a human being at war with each other. You also have overtones of the Cyclops in the single eye. You know, there's a reference to the Odyssey there. But there's something about the pleading of the AI, which doesn't know what death is all is going to, you know, doesn't know what being shut down will be like. And then, you know, the, as I said, the methodical lobotomization of the creature, I mean, of the creature, of the computer by the astronaut, that's very affecting and powerful. And then this was all then accentuated in classic, you know, filmmaking fashion by, you know, with by the acting Douglas Rain, you know, Canadian Shakespearean actor who voiced Hal, and then by Kubrick in post production by slowing the sound and the voice down a bit and doing some post production effects on the sound, very subtle.
Yeah.
And then the writing itself is very strong, I think, extremely strong. It rises almost to the level of Samuel Beckett or something. You know, this existential pleading.
Yeah.
By the computer, and you know, with by an entity that has no face beyond an eye. So yeah, very powerful scene. I still think it's one of the most powerful scenes ever shot.
It's kind of astonishing when you think about this was a big budget film. It involved all of these expensive techniques and. For example, and you write about this. This is a good part of the book where you write about all these techniques and the set and this 38-foot in diameter, 30-ton film centrifuge. I mean, this was an amazing, the most expensive set I think you said ever built at the time. And yet, Kubrick is still willing to improvise.
Oh, yeah.
He's still willing to sort of work in flux, which I find incredibly, I don't know, crazy or brave. It was amazing.
No, he was something else. It's almost a lazy cliche by writers on Kubrick to say that all of his chess playing in Washington Square Park when he was a kid had trained him for filmmaking.
Yeah.
But Kubrick himself has acknowledged or had acknowledged that it probably did have an impact on him, and it helped him be, you know, first of all, to think multiple moves ahead. And to kind of remain unsentimental and unrattled by the current crisis, you know, and all these things. So, but Kubrick, you know, the idea of taking a project of this scale and improvising every day, it really is an extraordinary thing. And the fact that he didn't fail, that he succeeded, is even more extraordinary.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. I mean, it can happen on a low-budget film that you're improvising and all that, obviously. You know, John Cassavetes was making films in the 60s, and, you know, some of his greatest work came out at the same time. And those were actor-based films with 16mm with the cinematographers, you know, hand-holding them and a lot of improvisation on the set, you know. But that's a totally different story than a gigantic science fiction production. I think I quote Tony Masters, the production designer, saying that the art department was suicidal because they would spend all this time and money and effort building sets and, you know, and working towards scenarios that would suddenly be, you know, then Stanley would come in the morning they're supposed to shoot it and say, no, I don't want to do that anymore. Let's do something totally different. You know? So it is a miracle that he brought it off.
Michael Benson, his book is Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
I'm Maria O'Mara, General Manager at KUER. We're a listener-supported public radio station, and that means we rely on listeners who contribute, sometimes even before the fund drive. Thanks to early birds like you who contribute, KUER can keep our on-air drives as short as possible. Please consider making a gift now. You can make a one-time donation, become a sustainer, or increase your sustaining pledge. You'll give us the momentum we need to cross the finish line. Just go to KUER.org and click Donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Michael Benson. We're talking about his book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Let's talk about those first screenings and the reaction from the studio brass. There's one story you tell about one reaction by an MGM executive. This was the day of a press screening. I think this was in Washington, D.C. And this is the same day you mentioned when Lyndon Johnson had announced he was not going to run for re-election. And the executive says after screening the film, well, we lost two presidents today, meaning the president of MGM, Robert O'Brien, was going to lose his job over this disastrous film that they had just seen.
Yes. Yes.
Talk a little bit about that initial, because everyone seemed to think this is a disaster and started to panic.
Well, that's true. The opening audiences for 2001 were primarily older, entitled representatives of entertainment business, you know, older film executives, you know, people who were, you know, film critics, well-established types who got the VIP invitations and the tickets to go see the previous screenings.
Right.
They were not prepared at all for such a radically experimental avant-garde piece of work. They were used to films that were really not taking big chances when it came to audience comprehension of what was happening. And they simply weren't prepared. Now, I should also add to that that the opening, you know, the film shown for those preview screenings and the film shown for the first couple weeks of the of screenings of 2001 for the public had 19 minutes more of material in it than the cut we know today.
Right.
And so there's a combination of factors at play in the early rejection of the film, and including critical slams by the New York City critical community almost without exception.
Right.
Put down the film. Again, the 19-minute longer 2001. So part of it was that you had people who were really not ready or perhaps able to take on board a film as innovative and unusual and new as 2001. Part of it is that there were some redundant scenes. I should say that, you know, Stanley himself did not see his own film from beginning to end with all the visual effects in place until he screened it for the MGM brass in Los Angeles in March 68, 10 days before the previous screenings in New York and D.C. That's when he saw his own final product, because the visual effects had taken so much effort and time and post-production to get in place, you know. So he didn't really have the time to think about it. The preview audiences were his test audiences. He didn't bring in small groups of people and hand out questionnaires, none of that stuff that was more common later.
Yeah.
You know, when those disastrous screenings took place, he was prowling the theater, especially in New York City, prowling that theater and watching. You know, he was gauging, you know, what Roger Karras, vice president of both of his production companies and his kind of New York City closest associate, Karras called, you know, said he was gauging the audience squirm factor. After the disastrous New York City screening, premiere of on April 3rd, 68, the next day Kubrick went into MGM headquarters, and there was a lot of pressure from top brass to trim the film. But he had come to the conclusion that it was necessary on his own. It seemed clear that he needed to cut some redundant scenes, and that's exactly what he did. And then critical reaction after the trims was much more positive, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's the story you tell which gives kind of an early clue about how younger people might have reacted to it rather than the kind of the established elites. And it's this 18-year-old young man, one of the producer's nephews, who was there at that Los Angeles screening for the brass and was completely bowled over by the film. Well,
yes.
The brass thought it was a disaster. He said it was the most amazing thing he had ever seen.
Yes, and so there you have it. You have this late 60s generational split right there in stark relief at the very first screening. The very first screening when Kubrick himself saw his own film with all the effects shots, as I just said, you already had this division between young and old, between the establishment and younger people who got it and were blown away by it.
You mentioned that disastrous world premiere in New York. People were streaming out of the at the intermission. No one seemed to like it or get it. And you describe Kubrick's reaction as kind of bewildered. And later you mentioned his wife, and you spoke with her as well for the film, that Stanley was tearing himself to shreds, that he was heartbroken, that he was kind of pacing the room wondering, you know, like, what am I going to do? At what point does it start to occur to him that this was a masterpiece? And at what point did the critics start to come around to the idea that this was something new, something original, and a masterpiece?
Yeah, I have to thank, by the way, Christiana Kubrick for taking me into her confidence and really, telling me very private things about that dark night of April 3rd, 68, you know, when Stanley really almost lost his composure. I believe the direct quote was, he looked like he was ready to cry. He didn't cry, but he was close, or something, she told me. Yeah. So you ask me, when did he come around and realize he'd made a masterpiece? Now, I don't know that he ever, Christiana told me that he actually was quite a humble guy. I mean, when you got him away from the set, you know, where he was the master of the universe, you know, he did not necessarily think of himself as the greatest director around. You know, he didn't necessarily have a good opinion of other directors. Yeah. But, and I think that the soundbite that I heard that really puts that in focus was from a Charlie Rose interview with her and her brother, Jan Harlan. And she said he hoped he was good, you know. So did he think it was a masterpiece? I don't know. Certainly in the Playboy interview in 1968, when he was asked to explain what the meaning is, you know, he made a reference to Leonardo and Mona Lisa. And he said, what would we think about Mona Lisa today if Leonardo had written on the back of the canvas, the lady is smiling because she's hiding a secret from her lover?
right.
And that indicates something about his level of confidence by the fall of 68 and what he'd accomplished, I would say.
You say Kubrick never again attempted anything of that scale, even though he still did amazing work and ambitious work, but nothing of that complexity. And I'm wondering, was he traumatized? Was he finished with that genre and wanted to move on? Why do you think?
I think that, 4 years of... I think probably another one would have killed him. Although, having said that, he wanted to do Napoleon. He wanted to do a really big budget, ambitious film on Napoleon, and it just didn't work out. And I think that if he had received studio backing to make that film, he probably would have made two films of the level of 2001. But, you know, it was such a excruciating endurance run, marathon to make that film. I mean, 3 years of intense labor with huge crews and a lot of money at stake and so on. And I think after that, Clockwork Orange was made on quite a low budget, and he just wanted to experiment with lighter, leaner, less grueling shoots. That doesn't mean that they weren't grueling. Every film production is kind of grueling. But I think it just got to be, I think he felt like he'd already done that. You know, again, though, setting aside that he wanted to do Napoleon, which would have been a huge, huge deal and lots and lots and lots of people and lots of money and so on.
Let me ask you finally the influence of this on the culture. I mean, John Lennon said he saw it pretty much every week, and David Bowie released Space Oddity a year later, and Spielberg said that 2001 was the big bang that inspired a generation of directors. So it's clear the impact it had on culture, and still does. But I'm wondering, put it in the context of today's science fiction films or even today's superhero films. How does this film play today, do you think?
Well, I think it's at the very origins. It's, it's the spring. It's the source of the genre when it comes to Hollywood big budget science fiction. So in 68, when the film came out, the reigning Hollywood paradigmatic genre was the Western still. The Western was sort of fading, but the Western was still, the main big budget Hollywood genre. And if 2001 had flopped big time the way, for example, what was the Western that flopped in the 70s, you know, Heaven's Gate. You know, if it had been a Heaven's Gate, Michael Cimino's second film, which took down a major film studio in the 70s, you know, then probably we wouldn't have any big budget Hollywood science fiction now, or we'd have a very different future for film. That means the present now. Right. But 2001 ended up being the highest grossing film of 68, despite all the bad reviews. And so it proved that science fiction, big budget science fiction, could make a lot of money and blow everybody away and get everybody talking. And so when it comes to contemporary, you know, James Cameron or, you know, contemporary, you know, I don't know, you can name Christopher Nolan, a bunch of other people who've been producing these, you know, quite interesting, some of them, science fiction movies for years. They wouldn't have been possible. They wouldn't have been possible without 2001. Now, how does it stand up to them? I think it's just in its own category. I mean, nothing has come close to that film. Again, I'm a partisan, but nothing has come close to the philosophical depth of that film, the expanse of space and time that it managed to convey with this kind of awesome sweep and accuracy and beauty. There have been really interesting science fiction films since then, really good ones, you know, but I don't think any of them really came very close to the impact of 2001.
Michael Benson, his book is called Space Odyssey. He joined us from a studio in Ljubljana, Slovenia. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.